on my day off during the Edinburgh Festival. The interview was great, and then I started getting some really negative messages on Twitter, and I didn't know why, but the strapline during the interview, they'd said something like, comedian thinks it's okay to laugh at baby loss. So I just kind of thought, everything I have been trying to do on national television with that one line, you have undone everything.
Welcome to Time to Talk TFMR, Termination for Medical Reasons. Our aim is to help you own your experience. I'm Catherine Mousley.
And I'm Hayley Manning. Thank you for joining us today. We're shortly going to be joined by Lou Conran. Lou is a writer and comedian, and in 2016, she had a TFMR after it was found that her daughter was not developing properly. Lou wrote and performed her I Love Lucy show at Edinburgh Fringe in 2017, all about the experience of losing her daughter.
So warm welcome to Lou. It's really nice to have you here.
Hello, thanks for having me.
I was going to listen to a little clip of your show so that everyone else can hear what you do, basically.
My daughter's real funeral was the second worst thing I've ever been through in my entire life. And all the caskets were lined up and she was there with probably about 25 or so other babies that hadn't made it that month. And as my mum and I sobbed in our grief, my dad, the Del Boy Lama, stared straight ahead, trying to stay focused, trying to stay strong. And he was beating out the rhythm that was being played out on the organ, just tapping out the beat of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, staring straight ahead, trying to stay strong, trying to be strong for his little girl, for me. And after the funeral, all I wanted to do was talk to the other mothers. That's all I wanted to do, because we didn't know each other, but we were all there, united in this one horrible thing that had happened, and yet none of us spoke to each other. And all I wanted to do was just talk to them to find out that what I was feeling and what I was going through was the same as them, to make it, well, for want of a better word, to make it normal. And the taboo of baby loss was playing out in front of all of our eyes, and we were the ones that could have done something about it, but none of us did. We all kept terribly British, and we kept calm, and we carried on. And we were no different. And after the service, we did what we do as a family after days out. We went for a curry. Yay. Of course we did. And as my mum and I sobbed through a jalfrezi, my dad, being my dad, couldn't show his emotions, so he ordered a curry called the suicide fowl and he ate it instead. And after about an hour, I think he really wished he hadn't done that.
Lou, that part, that piece, you know, where we go from, you know, the funeral of your daughter, it's just so heartbreaking to hear you speak of that. Mm. And I first heard you on Kerry Ed Lloyd's podcast, The Grief Cast.
Yeah.
And you're one of the first people that I've heard speak about it and speak so clearly about what this was.
It's crazy, isn't it? Because I knew nothing about this sort of process. I knew nothing about it at all. And it wasn't until I had the scan and they said, oh, something's wrong. And then I had to wait a week to go and see the specialist. And in that week, I spoke to a few of my friends who I consider close friends. And they'd sort of said that they had been through a similar experience or they knew people that had. Mm. And these are people that I've known for years, but they didn't discuss it. Mm. So I just thought, you know, why aren't we talking about this sort of thing? So that kind of started the whole of this off, because, you know, when you go through something like that, you want to tackle the whole world, don't you? And you want to sort it out for everybody. And so you're sort of fired up. So that's where this all came from, really.
And when I approached you about coming on and talking on our podcast, I was a bit nervous because I thought, you know, this happened for you in 2016. I have heard you speak about it, but I know that that's maybe been a few years ago. And I was a bit, you know, you're never quite sure. I was never quite sure, you know, where people are at with this now. But I have to say, you responded, you know, I sent the email and felt like 30 seconds later, I had a yes from you. And it was just so lovely that this is still something that you are
Oh, gosh.
Passionate about. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because it happens all the time. And it happens, like, colleagues of mine, fellow comedians have spoken to me about it. And during lockdown, I had three separate people, also comedians, that got in touch and said, during lockdown, this has happened to me. Mm. And I think it's hard enough as it is going through that. But in this scenario, when you're locked down, and I have friends that have also gone on to have successful pregnancies, but everyone's had to do it on their own.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine going through what I went through. I had a brilliant friend with me, but having to do that on your own in this time, it's just crazy. Mm. So it's, you know, and it's always really important to keep the topic open, I think, until people feel free to actually be able to speak about it without feeling a bit cringy or a bit embarrassed.
It's that isolating experience, isn't it? I mean, this is baby loss is such an isolating experience because we don't talk about it.
Mm.
There's been less talking about it. And then you have COVID on top of that, and you have a physical isolation going on as well.
Yeah.
All your support networks are just gone, haven't they?
Yeah, so exactly. And you got
double isolation.
Yeah. And the people that you would... We take it so for granted that the people that you want to reach out to hug and ask for that support directly, your network. Like, I was very lucky at the time. My girls, my best friends, they were like all over the country. They all came to my house, all of them, and they were with me. Mm. And they left when they felt they could. But to go through this in this time, oh my goodness me, it's just horrific as it is anyway. But
you've also
on top,
got the people that kind of think, you know, they don't know what to say, so they don't know how to support, so sometimes they do stay away.
Yeah,
so you get very lucky that, you know, you had those people around you in that period of time.
Yeah. Oh, don't get me wrong, it's been brilliant because it's filtered out the wheat from the chaff.
Yes. So I think we've all sort of experienced something like that. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, you find out who your friends are in situations like this. Mm. And I mean, it's a really horrible way to find out who your friends are, but you really do. It's quite revealing, really. Surprising, actually.
It's the same with any major life experience. I think you tend to find out who is there to support you the most. And sometimes it is the person you thought it wouldn't be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So let's bring it back to your show. You created this, a comedy. It's a comedy and a tragedy. Let's because it is that. Yeah. And those two things very classically go together.
Yes.
But you created this and you went and you performed it at Edinburgh Fringe in front of an audience.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that come from? I mean, at what point did you say, I'm going to do this?
Yeah, it's weird because I can't bear to watch the show from the clip that you've played, and I can't bear to sort of listen back to it.
Sorry.
Because I hate, it's just that I hate listening to anything I do. Like, when I have to listen to the episodes, I'm like, oh God, I just hate listening to myself. But sometimes I can't believe I did it. But I think where did it come from? I wrote an article for a magazine about the topic, and the responses and the messages I had from people regarding that kind of was relentless and made me realise that there was something that needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And having the skill set, well, I hoped I had the skill set to kind of tackle it, made me think that there was an opportunity here using comedy to perhaps kind of break down some barriers. So the article I wrote, an actress who lived locally got in touch and said she'd read it and could she perform it as a monologue at like a mother's group or something. And at first I was a bit like, oh, I don't know how I feel about that. And then I said, oh yeah, that's fine. And then I went to watch her performing it and I was like, oh, that's really quite impactful. And then after that I was like, oh, I've got to do something with this. And that's where the seed of the show sort of started, from that very article. And then Edinburgh kind of lends itself to it anyway. And it was, it was a real passion project. And I'm now looking back, I'm so glad that I did do it. And it did. Every day I had people coming up afterwards and talking to me about their own experiences. So that was hard in itself, having to do the show on your own. And then afterwards, having to chat to quite a few people every single day. That was
quite
hard.
Exhausting, isn't afterwards?
Yeah, yeah.
You're exhausted from telling your experience via a show, and then afterwards you're like taking on all these other emotions from other people as well.
Yeah, exactly. And because I was single when I went through it, and most of the people that talked to me about their experiences after the show, they were in a couple. Mm. So they could go through whatever they were going through during the show, and then they left together.
Yeah.
Whereas I did the show on my own, And then I went home on my own. So that was the difficulty, I think, in that. But it did just go to show how important it is to keep talking about it.
And especially adding that element of laughter to it, I think.
Yeah.
Like, it does, for me, when I listen to bits of your show, it felt like a relief that you can make it funny and also it's heartbreaking at the same time.
Yeah, but that's the thing though, isn't it? It's like we said earlier, that through awful, awful situations, the funniest things arise. And like when I'd spoken to a friend of mine when she was going through the same thing, and she'd said that while she'd had the induced labour and she was going through the labour, and then the woman from the canteen came in with a clipboard and an iPad, and she was like flicking through all the lunch options. Now I have to ask you, like, you know, what sandwich do you want? And Katie was like, obviously contracting and in extreme pain. And the woman was like, what sandwich do you want? And Katie was like, I don't care what sandwich. And she was like, right, well, I have to ask you, do you want tuna? Do you want ham? Do you want tuna? And she just went through all the list. And then Katie was like, oh, I'll just have tuna. And she went, so what bread do you want? Do you want gluten-free? Do you want brown? Do you want white? Do you want? And then she went through all of that. Do you want sweet corn? No. And it just went on and on and on. And then afterwards, Katie was like, oh, thank goodness she's done. And then the woman went, right, what do you want for your dinner? There's 180 options. So that sort of thing. It's like, oh my goodness. And if I could have put that in, I would have. But it's stuff like that that you just can't write it, you know? And
you start to, like, I think you don't remember these bits until afterwards. I remember it was April, so it was Easter, and I was obviously having contractions. Every time I had a contraction, I yelled for another mini egg. And I just had to put a mini egg in my mouth. So, and still to this day, I can't look at a pack of mini eggs without being reminded of the time, but it was just, mini egg. And like, I had this mouthful of mini eggs every time I had a contraction.
Yeah, mine was, the thing I can't have is Robinson's pink grapefruit squash, because that's all I was drinking. And every time I smell anything like it or see it, I'm like, it's weird, isn't it? What you kind of take home from that, other than the tragedy, obviously, but it's like, oh god, I can't ever drink that ever again now. You can't have your mini eggs.
Exactly. Lou, so I remember, I think I heard you speak on another podcast, which I can't remember the name of now, but I seem to remember you saying that there was a moment you went back to work about 6 weeks after your daughter was born.
Yeah.
And you were stood on stage performing.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
Well, I obviously I'm self-employed, and so the bills were racking up, and we don't get a pension, we don't get sick pay, we don't get anything like that. So it's like, I need to go back to work.
Yeah.
And I think I was in Bristol Jonglers, actually, which, as any comedian would tell you, was a horrific gig. And I was on stage, and I had sort of like an out of body experience where I was sort of blah, blah, blah going through. I'd just gone into autopilot, you know, everything's showbiz, everything's ha, ha, ha. And then I kind of fixed eyes on this guy in the audience, and he had this really weird look in his eye, and I was going to go and take the mickey out of him. But then I was like, I don't know why you're here. Maybe you're here at the comedy because you need cheering up. Mm-hmm. And then I had this kind of nanosecond of, oh my goodness, I can't do my job anymore. I just kind of had this kind of shutdown midway through what I was doing. And I was like, I don't know how I've managed to try and make people laugh when I'm going through the most excruciating pain. Mm-hmm. And they've come here to be cheered up, but they have no idea what I'm going through currently. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of decided, maybe I need to knock it on the head for a bit, because it's those realizations when you're actually on stage and you're on your own and you've got hundreds of people staring at you, waiting for you to make them laugh. And then you realize, oh shit, I can't do this anymore. So there's nowhere to go in that. So I was like, right, I need to give myself some proper time. And
it's like your emotional bucket is just empty. Finally get to that bottom bit. There's no water left anymore now.
No, exactly. And I don't know about you guys, but when I found it really difficult to cry because I didn't know what I really felt, I was still in shock. I was in shock for ages. About a year afterwards, I think I was still in shock. Mm-hmm. And so I found it really difficult to cry or feel any emotion, really. So I was just completely numb. So then standing on stage thinking, oh God, I can't do my job, it was just like, oh, well, everything was, oh, well.
Yeah.
I didn't know what else to say. I'd run out of words.
Yeah.
I'd run out of anything.
Yeah, that lacking in feeling and this numbness. I mean, after Luna died, I mean, I lost my voice for 3 days.
Oh, my goodness.
Literally could not speak. Gosh. Just gone. It was interesting. So I could talk to my husband and I could talk to the bereavement midwife. And anybody else, as soon as they started saying to me, how are you, asking me anything, I started to speak and then my voice just went, it just shut down.
Mm.
And I think quite a lot of people have this shutdown, is what you're sort of describing, you know, the sort of, I can't, there's too many inputs. It's like system overload.
Mm. But you're like, what do you do with yourself though? Because I think we mentioned in a previous episode that I spent time just sitting in supermarket car parks, just watching people go in and come out, or just driving.
Yeah.
I spent all day just driving, just around the same streets.
I've never sewn in my life. I was patchworking like a fiend. I was like ripping up sheets. I was ripping up clothes. I have to say I've made some really lovely blankets, but I was, that's all I could do was just really precisely cut squares of material and just sew. And every time I had a hospital appointment, because they'd left some placenta in me, and it was because I couldn't birth the placenta. So then I had to go to theatre, and then they'd left some in, and I was really, really ill. So I was still having contractions for about a month and a half afterwards. Mm. So I kept having to go back to hospital, back to the maternity unit.
Mm.
So I was just sat there like a mad woman, just patchworking. I took my Tupperware with my squares, took everything with me. So I didn't have to see all the pregnant people, didn't have to see anything else other than just focus on sewing.
Yeah, it's a way of sort of focusing our attention just to get through.
Yeah.
And so when you had this, I can't do my job anymore, mm-hmm. I mean, because I, you know, we've heard from a lot of women, we have felt it ourselves, that, you know, there's parts that just go, that just, you know, we feel, yes, our babies have died, and then so much else has gone with them. Did you have this sort of, this is not coming back? Did you panic about that? Did you not care? And yeah, how did that sort of work for you? Because I, you know, being funny is a big part of you.
Yeah. I guess when you do stand up, you kind of feel invincible, because if you can stand up on stage and you can make people laugh, once you've done that, you feel like you can do anything.
Okay.
And then when you go through something like this, you feel like you can do anything. Because you have to, like, as I said, I was on my own doing this. So after that, I just thought, I don't care about anything anymore. If I'm funny, fine.
Yeah.
If I'm not funny, fine.
Yeah.
I just didn't have... It sounds wrong to say I didn't have a care in the world. Obviously, I did, but I didn't care about the small things anymore.
Yes,
and, and actually, if anything, I don't know about you guys, but after I went through all of that, I actually found that my life progressed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, definitely.
Is that a really weird thing to say? But
yeah.
I
no.
just kind of... the drive that I had. So Emma, that's what I called my daughter, Emma's legacy is... I did some, as we all, I'm sure you've all done it, some charity work, mm-hmm. done some charity gigs, and I've, you know, and then I wrote the show, and her legacy drove me to kind of be where I am now. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, obviously I would like my life different and I would like to have my daughter here with me, but I haven't got that. So to kind of honor her not being here, it's pushed me so much more than I mm-hmm. think I ever would have before.
Yeah.
So I kind of still feel more invincible.
Yeah. And there's a part in your show where you say about you said to your daughter, Emma, that, you know, you were sorry.
Mm.
And that really got me in that part of your show, because I remember after Luna had died, I went and visited her at the funeral home, and I just sat and would write letters. And one of the letters I wrote was, I am so sorry that I wasn't able to bring you home, that you were poorly, all of those things. And so you really sort of, you know, the magic of your show is how you weave this tragedy and bring people with you, you know, because you have a whole audience sitting there in front of you. And you can hear them holding their breath when you're at those moments. Oh. And then you give them, they're being taken through this journey with you. It's a real sort of undulating wave. And you give them this sort of,
it's like permission.
It's permission, you do.
To breathe, you permission do, yeah. to laugh.
Yeah, and you give them a second.
Yeah.
You say, okay, this has happened. And then you go, and then this really bizarre or ridiculous thing, here it is, and it's funny, and you can laugh at it.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay. You're basically saying it's okay.
Yeah, because I think that's the one thing, well, there was lots of things my mum said about me doing the show. She, oh my God, you're not doing a show about that. How on earth are you going to make that funny? And she's
does
right.
Does she have the accent?
Yeah, she does. She actually does speak like that. So
I'm sure your mum is lovely.
I'm sure your mum is lovely.
Yeah, Jan's a unique woman in her own way. But she was like, how on earth are you going to make this funny? And I thought, I don't know. Mm. I don't know. And it is what it is, and it will be what it will be. But as I said before, it's like, through all the awful things, funny things happen. Mm. Like being given the wrong date for the funeral.
Yeah.
I could not have written that. Yeah. And I would not have wanted to write that, but going to somebody else's funeral, it's okay. Well, there you go. You can't. Funny things happen in the tragedy, and it's
real life. This is real life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think I remember saying to Hayley just before you came on that I'd just literally taken the tablet to end the pregnancy in a room we'd been sitting all day, and my partner at the time, he had put a big sanitary towel on his head and a cardboard bedpan and was just walking around the corridors with this on his head. And you just think, what the actual, like, why? Yeah. Why are you like, why am I here? What am I doing? Yeah. Like, I've just ended my child's life and you've got a cardboard bedpan on your head. And
the, just, the guy that I call him the donor, because that's all he was worth. He was sat there and he was sort of pacing around the room when we sort of said, all right, this is definitely going to happen. And he said, oh, I just can't. I can't do this. Oh, I can't go through this. Oh, no, I can't go through it. And I could see the nurse looking at him and she was getting more and more angry because she's obviously going, well, Louise doesn't really want to go through this, but she's the one that's going to have to.
Yeah.
And he was like, he was being all so dramatic and like, oh no, I just can't do it. And I could see her looking at me going, I'm going to tell him in a minute that he's going to hold your hand and he's going to be there. And I was thinking,
please don't.
Don't do that. He's the last person I want in the room with me. Oh my God, let him go away. Yeah. Just send him away. But it's so funny, isn't it? Mm-hmm. How people react to that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then when I sort of like had the first scan and then they said something's wrong and then they sent us to another hospital, in between that I rang my parents and my dad was like, oh right, oh brilliant, so am I getting a train set or am I getting whatever else? And I was like, you're not getting anything, dad, it's not good news. And then I could hear my mum in the background going, oh God, has she got to have an abortion?
Oh God.
And it was just like, oh well, I mean, we don't know yet, but it's
Mum.
Perhaps just say, are you okay? So, yeah.
You can't.
Crazy how people
react. Yeah, exactly. And people say things in these moments and you just, and you think, what planet are you on? But yeah, you're right. And Lou, you've mentioned it a few times and actually I'd like to sort of ask you a little bit more about this or just explain the relationship you were in at the time. So it was an unplanned pregnancy because you were told you were infertile, basically.
Yeah.
So you thought you would never have children of your own, which was something that you had to grieve and go through because it was something you did want children.
Yeah.
And you were told, think again, basically.
Yeah.
And you went through that, then met this person and you got pregnant.
Yeah. I mean, basically, it all started off because my mum had quite an early menopause. Mm-hmm. So my sister had some tests and she was told that she was perimenopausal. And I think she was 40 at the time. I was 38. So Nicola said, oh, you better go and have some tests. And then I went and had the AMH. Is it the AMH test? Yeah, which... anyway, I have so many angry opinions on that test because they don't really give you the correct information and nobody really tells you that it's actually not accurate and it changes every month and it's this, that and the other and blah blah blah. Anyway, So I had that test and they said, oh no, you've got nothing left. Nothing, just nothing left.
Just a bit, just direct, very blunt, direct.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And so I was sort of like, oh my God, I've always wanted kids. What do I do? And I'm too old now to have my eggs frozen. And if I wasn't, I haven't got any eggs left. Mm. And then I had that conflicting thing of, but I'm still having periods. So surely I must, yeah, that whole thing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Then they basically said, oh, you've got a year, you know, before you're dry and crusty with a dusty womb. So I was like, oh, okay. So I automatically just was like, oh, well, I'll just have to have a sperm donor then.
Yeah.
So I went into, and then when I was in the sperm clinic, I saw one of the guys coming in to
make his deposit.
Make his deposit. And I was like, oh God, that's the one I'm going to get. And it was just awful. It did really bad shoes. It's very important for a man to wear good shoes.
I agree.
And then I sort of dealt with it and I grieved it and I went through it and then found this amazing lady that did Chinese medicine. Never believed in any of that whatsoever, but she kind of reversed the menopausal thing. And then before I knew it, she made me so fertile that I sat on this bloke's doodah and then got pregnant. So it was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Here we go.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I realized that he was a massive idiot. And I thought, of course I've got pregnant by an idiot.
Because that's how life happens.
Yeah, exactly. And then it was just really hard to then accept that I was pregnant, having them gone through all of that, going, oh, I'm never going to have a kid. And then being pregnant. And it's like, oh God, I don't know how I feel about it now because I've kind of got used to the idea that I was never going to have a baby. So you're going through it all over again.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a lot, just, isn't it? It's like scary that then being Sod's Law is alive and well. It just really is.
But there's no help for you though, is there? There's no help for that sort of thing. There's no like office that goes, oh, have you just been told this? Well, come on in and we'll talk about it. You can go to counselling, but, you know, I went to the doctors and I was like, I don't want to go on antidepressants. Can you, I don't know, can I do counselling or CBT or something like that? And the doctor went, oh, well, there's a really long waiting list for counselling, one-to-one counselling. But I'll tell you what, I'll sort out some CBT for you. And I was like, oh, okay, right. Don't really know a lot about it, but I'll go along. And it was a computer. There was like a bay of computers and everyone was sat with their headphones on having their CBT via videos on a computer.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, one video was, oh, I've got money worries. Another video was, oh, my partner is abusive. And I was like, well, where's the video that tells me that I'm infertile or now I'm pregnant and there's nothing for that. Do you know what I mean? So you kind of have to deal with it on your own and just get on with it. So
yeah.
It was a bit of a pickle. The whole of it was.
And what what I'm sort of hearing that as well is that, you know, you had this being told you were infertile, had to grieve that, get pregnant, surprised by that.
Yeah.
And have to get your head around that you were pregnant and you were pregnant with somebody who is not your ideal partner.
Oh, far from ideal.
If we put it mildly, suboptimal. You then have, you're hit with this at your anomaly scan, and you say in your show, and I've heard you say in the other podcasts and stuff, that you had just started to get your head around the fact that you are pregnant, you're having this baby, that the partner, he is not going to be with you on this.
Nope.
And you've gotten your head around some of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But then at that scan, you're told there is a problem, and then subsequently you have to end the pregnancy.
Yeah.
And you deliver Emma. Was there a moment where you went, this was my chance, and I don't know if I will get another chance? I guess what I'm trying to understand is if, because you don't have any children.
Nope.
And you know, we talk so much about rainbow pregnancies. But the reality is that not everybody has a rainbow pregnancy that is successful or has a chance to even have a rainbow pregnancy. So what's that like for you? I'm assuming there was another grieving process.
I don't know whether there was really, because I think I'd done it.
Okay.
And I know that sounds really blunt and a little bit, but since the age of 38, when I was told that's it, I had been through every possible emotion regarding my fertility. And then when it came to losing Emma, I just kind of thought, oh, well, of course. I'd kind of held my hands up just when, well, of course this is the way it ends. And I just kind of, yeah, it's, I don't know how to explain it really, but I just kind of was like, it was never meant to be. So I was told that it wouldn't happen, and then it did, and then it didn't.
Yeah.
So I've been through up, down, round the houses, everything. And now, like, I'm menopausal and I'm dry as a bone. So now nothing's happened. Like, I haven't had a period for Christ knows how long. And, you know, I'm probably the happiest I've ever been because I've been through it all, and I don't have that worry now of, oh my God, what will I do if I get pregnant now? Because I'm in a really happy phase of my life. I've got a wonderful partner, and, you know, if by some miracle one of my crusty eggs did decide to
blow the dust off and then go tumbling down the tubes.
Yeah, then if I did by some, you know, I don't know, if there's one laying dormant somewhere that decides to wake itself up and I did get pregnant, I think that we'd be okay and it would be fine and I'd deal with it. But at the moment I'm like, oh God, it's, you know, life is the best it's actually ever been. And obviously I would prefer my daughter to be here, but she's not.
Yeah. So. No, but it sounds like you've really made some peace with that because of everything that you've been through. You've really had to go into these quite dark corners.
Yeah.
And process that. And so, you know, it sounds like there's a lot of acceptance in.
A lot of acceptance. Where you're at. Yeah. And a lot of patchworking. And, I think when I look at my friends now who we're similar ages and they've got young kids, and part of me just thinks, am I allowed to swear?
Of course.
Part of me just thinks, oh, thank fuck for that, because I just don't know how they do it. And I can now do my podcast and I can get drunk whatever night of the week I can. But whatever night of the week that I can, you know, that I need to for the podcast. Yeah. And it doesn't matter if I wake up with a hangover. Yeah. The only person that I have to deal with is myself. So, yeah.
It does put you it's on this funny, different path, doesn't it? I think we've been saying that before, like with what me and Hayley have been through, and now we've come together with this podcast. You know, perhaps all this was meant to happen in a way to get us to the place we are now, to be able to get to a place to help others. And I guess it's the same with you and your show, and like, you've come around to the full circle of that and that closure as well.
Yeah, I think it is that. And I think there's a few people, I went to this kind of weird awards thing. This lady got in touch with me and said, oh, would you come and perform some of your show at this award ceremony thing? And I wasn't really quite sure what was involved, because at the time I was sort of like saying yes to everything because I just wanted to talk about it and talk about it. And I went to this awards thing and, oh God, this sounds really bleak. And it was, but it was like an awards thing for people with dead babies, and the award would be for, I can't even remember the categories, but every award that they were presenting was accompanied by a massive picture of their dead child.
Jesus.
And I know. And I was kind of at the point where I was getting myself sorted and I was, da, 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 but there was no trigger warning as I went in, and there was nothing to tell me that that's what was going to happen. And I just kind of thought, there's all these people in that, there was maybe 100 or 150 or so people in that room. And I just thought, how many people are in the same situation as me, where they're kind of on the precipice of, oh, I'm doing really well, and now I've gone to this because it's a really good charity function, raising money for, I don't actually know what it was raising money for, but I'd agreed to go and do this thing because I was so passionate about it. But there's so many different ways that people deal with their situation. And obviously the lady that had organised that was dealing with it in her own unique way. And I just kind of thought, how many people are in this situation? A, we're all here this one night. B, how many people are in the same situation as me that didn't expect this?
Yeah.
And how many people are okay with it? you know, it's...
And then you're like, how the hell did I end up here? Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's such a weird world, isn't it? But the point was, it's like, oh, we're all here for the same reason. So at the end of the day, we all want to help in whatever way we can. Mm. Yeah. Do you know, I waffled on so much there. I completely forgot what your question was. I was just like waffling on vehemently, like, yes, what a terrible award ceremony.
No, I think Catherine was just sort of talking about this, the moving through this sort of processes. You know, I'm 4 years post TFMR. Catherine, you're what, 3.5?
Nearly 4 years. Four and about 3 weeks, actually.
Yeah. So, you know, there is a real difference between you're 1 week out from this experience to 4 years, 5 years, 6 years post this experience. It's a very different way of being able to talk about it and what you want to do in your life. I mean, you spoke about how it changed everything, really, and your outlook. And
yeah.
So, yes, these are the things that sort of come out of it. Lou, I just wanted to ask about, you know, reaction to your show. Because when we were doing a bit of research, we saw some maybe less informed comments about particularly your appearance on Lorraine. And just... What do you feel about that? About people that sort of respond in less informed ways?
Yeah, I went on Lorraine on my day off during the Edinburgh Festival of the run of that show.
Okay.
So the Edinburgh Festival, if you're not aware, is manic and it's like being in a completely different world and you don't know what's going on from 1 minute to the next, and halfway through you don't even know your own name. So put that on top of doing a show about losing your baby, and then the Lorraine show gets in touch and goes, oh, this is interesting, we're going to fly you down and we'll put you up in a hotel and we'll put you on the show because this is really important. Great, okay, on my day off, that'll be brilliant. And then I got there and the interview was great and it was brilliant. And then after I was going back to the airport to go back to Edinburgh, I started getting some really negative messages on Twitter. And I didn't know why, because I just thought what I'm doing is a really positive thing. But I don't know what they call it, the strap line under the during the interview, they'd said something like, comedian thinks it's okay to laugh at baby loss. So I just kind of thought, everything I have been trying to do on national television, prime time, breakfast, with that one line, you have undone everything. And all these messages coming in. And I just thought, I am trying so hard to do the right thing. And yeah, it was so hard. And then I didn't have an agent at the time, and somebody else's agent got in touch with me, and she, because I was like, I don't know what to do about this. I was on Facebook going, what do I do? How do I respond to this? And she just said, you do nothing and you go back to Edinburgh, you get a pint of cider and you get on with it, basically. And I just thought, yeah, because when you're in that bubble, the Edinburgh bubble of that sort of thing, it's like, oh my God, you're so hypersensitive to everything. But she was absolutely right. And then obviously I was on the plane on the way back and I couldn't do anything. And in that time, things kind of settled down. But it's just like, wow, people just aren't listening. They're seeing what they want to see. And then the Daily Express put it in the Daily Express. And then somebody said, oh, it's just clickbait. That's all they want. And then I just thought, what's wrong with these people?
Yeah.
This is people's lives, though. Like, Hayley and I have had conversations about stuff I've experienced in the media and the way they've handled it and the taglines. And you just think, this is someone's experience and their memories and their emotions and their lives. They just didn't care.
Yeah. And it's not like we're doing it, like, I didn't go on Lorraine to be famous. Why on earth would I want to be famous for, oh, there she is talking about a dead baby again. Oh God, no. I did it because there was a purpose to doing what I was doing. So it's I got really fuddled about it.
How did you deal with that criticism long term? I mean, was it a sort of drink the cider, get on with it?
Yeah.
Was there any sort of, that was the long-term plan.
Literally, get back, drink the cider, get on with it. Because, and actually, if anything, I have to be honest, it brought more people to my show.
Yeah. So, there you go.
So it actually, in its negativity, it actually
provided me with more of an audience that had obviously gone, oh, well, I'm going to go and watch that show and be outraged.
Yeah.
And then they
were.
Do
you think they were? So. Yes. Okay. So I was going to say, do you think they were outraged? I can't see how they would be.
No.
Because they would have sat and gone, ah.
No. I was worried about, because there's certain points during the show that I thought, oh gosh, this might be a trigger for people. And
yeah.
I might have people walking out. And at the entire time that I've actually done the show, only one person has walked out during the show, and that's at the point where I'm talking about the birth and everything.
Yeah.
But the recurring thing that does happen during the show is while I'm talking about the birth, I've had several men faint.
Really?
Yeah. So.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's always at the same point. So I just think, oh, I'm describing giving birth to my daughter who may or may not be dead because they warned me.
Yeah.
She may be alive, she may draw her last breath,
yeah.
Blah, 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 blah. Obviously, I didn't talk about that in the show, but that's in my head, that's all I can remember. So
yeah.
I'm doing the words, and at exactly the same point, I've had about four or five men pass out at the same point.
Wow.
And I just think, but that's happened to me. I don't know. Maybe I'm really
cold-blooded
about it.
No, but you know what I wonder? Because I was just saying that when I was watching it, I can feel that the audience is holding their breath. And I actually wonder if they physically...
Oh, maybe.
They are just holding their breath.
Yeah, that's...
that, you know, that they are feeling it so much for you.
Oh, and I never even thought of that.
Maybe just like, what is going on.
These pussies.
Dare I say we're the stronger species, of course.
Of course we are, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
No, but honestly, Lou, when I'm watching it, I feel this holding of breath. And I wonder if
that's interesting,
held it too long and just conked out.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, I never thought, because as I said, I've not watched it. I can't bring myself to watch it. So, all right, well, maybe I will have to watch it then to try and appreciate what you're saying there. Well, I still think get on with it.
Yeah. Lou, I want to ask about, because we were just talking about media and, you know, okay, so TFMR, Termination for Medical Reasons, has had some more media attention in the last, I'd say in the last year or so, but it's not always been well handled, I think. Do you have any thoughts on how we deal with the media when we're talking about TFMR or what? Yeah.
My limited experience of this is, I think people that are reporting on this, 9 times out of 10 haven't experienced it. Mm. So they don't know what they're talking about.
Mm.
So they don't have that kind of empathy. So they don't know how to tackle it in a human way. And I think that majority of the time it's sensationalized, and it does depend who's telling their story. Like when Meghan Markle said that she'd had a miscarriage, a lot of that was handled really badly because the press just don't like her. So that doesn't help.
Yep.
And I think when Lily Allen had her stillborn a couple of years ago, gosh, it was more than that, wasn't it? That again was really handled really badly because of her perceived personality or whatever. People just didn't really like her. It's weird, isn't it? If you're the people's princess, you know, if it was Kate or somebody that everybody loved, I think it would be handled differently.
Yeah, Amanda Holden had a stillbirth, didn't she? Quite a late one.
Yeah.
And I remember that being dramatically different to like Meghan Markle and Lily Allen.
Yeah, yeah.
Because she is, I guess, highly regarded.
Yeah.
More so.
But I think if you don't have personal experience of it, I don't know how you can possibly comment on this.
And you've got the Chrissy Teigen recently, I have to draw that back to the TFMR that she had. And that was handled that was awful. I think that's what we spoke about.
I'll have to have a look at that.
Some of the comments on social media were absolutely disgusting.
But that's not media. I mean, that's social media, but those are like random people from the public. It's like Lou receiving these comments from the random people from the public.
Yeah.
That's slightly different from media.
But
reporting.
Hasn't it all changed now, though? There's so many more people that are reliant on social media now. And I think that it's kind of coming up now that the media, telly, whatever, especially with the last year, so many more people are going on social media doing their own things. So it's kind of the same, I think
there's people who don't know you. Do you remember? Yeah. I had people calling me a murderer, sick in the head. Like, I bought my baby because he wasn't perfect. Like, you know, he never would have stood a chance against someone like her. And it's like, these people don't even know who you are, yet they're entitled to have this awful opinion about you and what your actions.
I don't know whether you guys have had, but after I wrote the initial article about everything, I had people sending me pictures of their dead babies. So
really?
Yeah. So that's, I had to change my name on Facebook because I kept getting people feeling that it was okay for them to, obviously they want to share their story. Yeah. And of course I've got no problem with that. But yeah, quite a few people sending me photographs of their child. And obviously I've got photos of Emma and nobody's seen those. They're private. They're for me. You know, I wouldn't want anybody else to see the pictures because they would judge her. You can see her illness, you can see she's very poorly, and I wouldn't want anyone else to be given the opportunity to comment on that, because that's for me and, and me and her basically. But for other people to send me photographs of their child,
yeah, like the boundaries are removed.
I think you have to ask permission, don't you really? Would you mind?
Or I think it's a really interesting point, because I think within baby loss circles there's this kind of idea that that is something that is acceptable, I'm going to say right now, and so for example, so we have an Instagram page and we ask people if they would like to share their stories, and we share it on a Tuesday, and there's a hashtag called TFMR Tuesdays, and we always invite people to send us, if they would like to share a picture, they can send us a picture of whatever they like.
Yeah.
So this could be a scan photo. It could be an image of their baby. It could be a teddy bear. It could be, I don't know, a picture of a tree that reminds them. It could be absolutely anything.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that quite a lot of people choose not, well, I don't know if they're choosing not to show a picture of their baby, but I think there is a feeling of, am I going to be judged?
Yeah.
As you say, you know, am I going to be judged about what my baby looks like?
Yeah.
And I have never shared any pictures of Luna on social media. And that's because I have some feelings around the privacy of that. And that there are a limited amount of pictures I have of her. And I want them for me.
Yeah.
So there are other things I will share that are associated with her, but I don't share the images.
No, I don't. No. It's weird, isn't it? Because I look at her and I, as I said, I can see that she's ill. And given that my mum is quite vocal about a lot of things and she doesn't think before she speaks, are you going to have an abortion? So I don't, you know, if I was to show my mum that the photos of Emma, my mum would not be able to edit her initial first thought.
Yeah.
And that for me, I don't need to hear it.
Well, no. And why would you? Yeah, exactly. You don't need to hear it.
No.
And it just ends up being something that is like a earworm.
Yeah.
And you don't need that.
No.
You've been through enough.
Yeah. Exactly.
And you love your daughter.
Yeah. Yeah. I do have a photograph of her feet or one of her feet on the wall. And that's enough for me. Mm. And that's in my bedroom. And that's, nobody else can see that. That's for me. But I don't mind people oversharing, but I just think, I don't know what you want me to do with that. I don't know what you want me to do.
I think a personal email of just being sent these things is tricky. When it's where we're doing a social media page where we're saying, if you would like to, then you are invited to, that's a different thing. Yeah. And I think it's really important to say that there are these differences in how we wish to share, not share, that, you know, it's all okay.
Absolutely. You know? Everybody's journey is completely different. And I chose to write a show about it.
Yeah.
Oh, good for me. But somebody else might be sitting at home going, oh God, I can't believe she's done that. Absolutely fine. But everybody deals with it differently. So
exactly.
You can't, there's no right or wrong, is there?
No.
Sounds like a good time to wrap up there. We've just got a bit of a question that we always ask every single guest. We call it the TFMR from our takeaways. What advice or piece of hope would you give to women and families who are either facing a TFMR or have undergone a TFMR?
Just the one thing that I've said to several people is that it doesn't matter how long it takes, but life does get better and the pain and the hurt that you feel now won't always be there. And you will laugh, and it's okay to laugh again. You know, that guilt that you feel when you have a little giggle about something on the telly and you think, oh God, I'm grieving, I'm not allowed to laugh. Of course you are. Yeah. You can do whatever you like, whenever you like.
Yeah.
Don't send me a picture of it.
Fair enough. That's really great. Thank you so much, Lou, for
I could talk about it for hours and bore everybody.
No, but, well, you know, we'd love to have you on again at some point, because I feel like there's other elements of your story here. Yeah. And I feel like we haven't really spoken too much about Emma, and I just want to acknowledge her in all of this. And, you know, we're having this conversation with you here because of her and that, you know, you've done a lot to raise awareness on this subject. Thank you so much, Lou.
Thank you for listening to our podcast today. We really hoped you found it comforting in places. Let us know your thoughts. Please message us over on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Time to Talk TFMR. Don't forget that you can also subscribe to our podcast via Podbean, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. It's a really great way to make sure you get all of our episodes as soon as they are published.
Over the next few weeks, we'll be speaking to Sally Kelly, and we've decided to dub her our resident specialist midwife. And a listener, Stephanie Cunningham, is also joining with her. And we're going to be speaking to them about surgical termination, a very important episode that many of you have been asking for.
That's all for this time. Thank you, and please take gentle care of yourselves.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.